David Ross is a great friend of mine. He's a very successful guy. We were competitors but friends in real estate in New York in the old days. He's a great guy. He is, by the way, I think he's probably more inclined to be a liberal, if you want to know the truth. But he likes me. He respects me. We're doing a fundraiser there. We're doing another fundraiser with another friend of mine. And I understand the fundraiser was totally sold out, and it's very successful. I don't think. I think it just makes Steve much hotter. I explained. I didn't speak to him yet. I'll see him in a little while. The controversy makes Steve Ross hotter. He'll figure that out in about a week. But he's very happy. He's got a very successful, a lot of people are going. We have two fundraisers. One is Steve, one is another gentleman. And I guess they're going to raise $11 or $12 million. Not billion, a million.
Well, Mr. President, what are you
talking about? I'm getting used to saying billion. We're talking about a lot of money.
Hello, and welcome to The Reason Podcast. I am your special guest host, Catherine Mengue Ward. Matt Welsh is somewhere at an undisclosed French location, and I am joined today by my colleagues Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and special guest star, Elizabeth Nolan Brown. Say hi, kids.
Hi, kids.
Hi.
Happy Monday.
So, a lot of news to cover this week, including a massive immigration raid, fallout from the El Paso and Dayton shootings, as well as the suicide of disgraced, I guess, if we were the New York Times, we would say disgraced financier, but maybe we want to use grifter or monster or something. Jeffrey Epstein. First, though, I want to talk about boycotts and SoulCycle. This is mostly because I enjoy picking fights, and I suspect there may be some disagreement amongst us here about how to think and talk about this controversy. Very briefly, the whole thing got going after the Washington Post reported last week that Stephen Ross, the chairman of the board of the company that is the parent company of SoulCycle and Equinox Gyms, had thrown a fundraiser for Donald Trump, the one that was referenced at the clip at the beginning of the episode. There seems to be a desire to make a statement or react to that fact. And so people are boycotting SoulCycle. My theory about this is that people were just looking for a reason not to go to the gym in August and also hate Donald Trump. And this is the perfect opportunity. But maybe I am too cynical. Nick, are boycotts good? Did they help change things?
Well, that's ideologically motivated boycotts. It's, you asked two separate questions, though. Are they good and do they change things? And those, you know, those are kind of independent of one another. And the fact is that most boycotts fail in whatever their stated purpose is. Occasionally they do. So something like the Montgomery bus boycott during the civil rights period actually had an effect on the bottom line of the transportation company and had an impact. Other things like the attempt, and I'm thinking about the modern era of kind of woke boycotts, really, I think could be dated back to 2014 when people wanted to boycott Mozilla Firefox because the then president, newly named president of the nonprofit that runs Mozilla, had been found out, Brendan Eich had been found out to have donated money for Prop 8, which was an anti-gay marriage initiative in California. That didn't work. It didn't kill Firefox, although it did destroy Brendan Eich's career there. He had to step down. So, you know, just thinking about these kinds of things from a libertarian perspective, I think ideologically motivated boycotts make sense, or embargoes. We talk a lot about punishing people and praising them with the power of the marketplace or the power of the purse. So I think it makes sense. In this particular case, this SoulCycle stuff is kind of fascinating, partly because SoulCycle and Equinox are trying to say that, you know, the man in question here really is a passive investor in their organization. That's simply not true. But I think, you know, just broadly speaking, we should recognize it's tedious if you have to vet the politics of everybody that you shop with or buy from, but it makes sense from a libertarian perspective.
But Peter, isn't it bad if everything is politics all the time, everywhere?
I think on the one hand, yes. And on the other hand, yes. Living a life that is entirely politicized, in which every single decision you make is about is about Donald Trump or about Hillary Clinton or about Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton or whoever, or about Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi. If those are key figures in your decision about which $40 an hour bike to ride, $42 an hour bike to ride at a gym with a bunch of other people paying $42 an hour.
It's already mostly a symbolic activity. Why would you say, but politics?
I basically think that what you were saying about the exhaustingness of it is totally right. That I have a gym membership. I sometimes exercise. When I do that, one of the things that I don't want to do at all is think about Donald Trump or Mitch McConnell or Nancy Pelosi or Hillary Clinton or Elizabeth Warren or Kamala Harris or Bernie Sanders or any of those people. I just want them to be completely out of my mental space during that time. That is, in fact, part of what like physical activity and the joy of it is for. But here's what I will also say. People should buy products or not buy them for absolutely any reason they want. And if this is what you, if this for some reason gives you pleasure, if you believe that this gives meaning to your exercise routine or lack thereof, or to your economic choices, then go ahead, enjoy it. Know that it probably won't make much difference. I think the best case that it will make any difference at all was made by Josh Barrow in New York Magazine. And he has made an argument that I think is somewhat compelling, that SoulCycle and Equinox are actually somewhat unique properties in that what they do is they monetize consumer loyalty. You have to have, they want basic, they can get away with charging so much because it's a nice experience, but also because they really make you feel like you're part of something that's good and that you're happy, that you're part of a community, that you're happy to be part of, that you're happy to pay $42 an hour or actually more in some cases if you want to reserve the good bikes early.
Oh my God, are there good bikes?
So in fact, yes.
Wait, can we take a brief break here? Has anyone on this podcast ever been to SoulCycle or an equivalent product?
So there is an equivalent product at my gym, but I do not participate.
Nick?
I have not.
No. Okay. So we're all just going to
speak from a point of view. Because it's $10 and it's against One World.
Barrow comes at this from having done some research, and there's a great piece that he wrote in June about how SoulCycle is actually now doing a kind of airline style market pricing for their better bikes. And you can have, it's not quite that
do they
you
have
pay more
legroom?
For the best ones, but you
I was going to say they have more delays, right?
To the center of the action, again, because it's all about a kind of loyalty, of good feeling.
SoulCycle people are the worst, and I think as a class, worse than Donald Trump supporters. So it's really hard for me to take sides.
I like your
this,
hot take here. Okay, tell me more. Tell me more about the culture war between Donald Trump and SoulCycle people.
No, I mean, SoulCycle people are generally the worst. Like the worst of the worst sort of like exercise.
What do you mean?
They like want to convince you. I mean, they're kind of like, they always want to like vegans or like people.
You were
going to
say they're like vegans. Yeah.
Like now people on the like all meat diets too. Like so they always want to tell you how great it is and how they weren't convinced either until they did it. And it's just like, no, like I'm never going to like that. But like Peter said, I think people should do what, you know, makes them happy with their money. I just doubt that they're actually boycotting.
Look, I said it's exhausting to live in this world, but it is the world we live in. And thinking of stuff like keto diets or, you know, people who are into CrossFit, not all of them, but I know a ton of libertarians who love CrossFit.
CrossFit
partly or maybe even mostly because the founder, you know, is a self-identified libertarian. Same thing with the paleo diet. You know, we live in a world that is almost, because we're post-subsistence level, everything is symbolic. And I think it's ultimately it comes down to whether or not it's a good boycott, you know, to boycott anything related to Donald Trump rather than the idea of like, are our purchases going to somehow reflect our inner values and things like that. And again, I'm not saying it's a good thing. It is exhausting to think about, but that's the world we live in.
So my desire, which is probably selfish here, is to try and draw a distinction between different types of product choices or boycotts. And it seems to me like I'm thinking, okay, well, what do I consume or not consume because of something symbolic or ideological? And one answer is in my household, we mostly don't eat meat. And when we do, we buy like super duper fancy pants, like this cow like lived on a cloud of cow happiness until its peaceful death of old age type meat. Right. This is not
until it was put in a cage. And
yes. Thank
tortured.
You, Temple Grandin. So Like, this is not largely my choice. It's my husband's choice, but I'm a good wife, and so I support it. But the question is, the thing that I tell myself and that he tells himself is, okay, well, that's sending a price signal about a broader series of choices that the industry can make. Should, you know, is there a large market for ethical meat or meat alternatives? Here, look, I'm buying it. Now you know there's a market. Whereas the I hate Donald Trump, I'm not going to go to SoulCycle this month thing sends at the very least a more muddied signal and not necessarily something that a particular brand can choose to change about their business practices. Is that just me trying to justify my semi-boycott while hating this other one? Or do I have any kind of legit point there?
It sure sounds like it's a mix.
I think that, that SoulCycle's, the investor in question here, could choose not to host fundraisers for Donald Trump. And
right.
like that's a very clear market signal if they lose a significant percentage of their business. And again, I'm not against, I don't think there's anything wrong with this. I just think that when I am trying to, you know, sort of have leisure time, which I would consider like exercise as leisure time, I do not want to be thinking about anybody in politics if
so
I can avoid it.
What you're saying is you would not enjoy being in the same SoulCycle class with Fox pundit Erin Elmore, who says that she is going to wear her MAGA hat at SoulCycle this week to show her solidarity with
great, good for her, but no.
How does this fit in with, you know, like Taylor Swift in the fashion issue of Vogue, the September issue coming out, you know, in a very woke way?
First of all, I want to say, I always, always ask myself the question about all political issues. How does this fit in with Taylor Swift in the fashion issue of Vogue? So this is a good start. Sorry, go ahead.
I'm glad it was Nick
but
that asked
it's,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, but I mean, as she was criticized because she didn't, you know, endorse anybody in 2016, whereas, you know, Katy Perry and a bunch of other people actually appeared at the Democratic National Convention in order to endorse Hillary Clinton. I mean, don't we, you know, are we really going to say that, like, we don't care about who, you know, in a wide variety of things we choose to consume and lend our psychic validation to? You know, it's I've never bought a Taylor Swift record, and I don't think, you know, well, she took forever to get on Spotify because she's really mean to her fans. But I don't think streaming stuff once in a while that she gets like 1/10 of a penny from me. But it is like you either validate somebody or not, partly an artist based on their political commitments. We all probably like certain types of movie makers or musicians or authors, either because of or despite their political commitments.
Is Stephen Ross an artist of calorie burning?
He's an artist of dollar allocation, I think. But
that's no different, you know, really. I mean, I'm actually interested in, I don't know how you find out what Coke Food does, you know, the owner, the company that was raided in Mississippi. But the fact that they were actually employing so many illegal immigrants, it makes me want to buy their products more rather than
apparently
less.
Have, just to be clear, nothing to do with the Coke brothers.
Yeah. Which is actually a little disappointing to me. So another thing that happened this weekend that I think feeds into this question is, or I guess last week, Julian Castro, who I think is still a presidential candidate or something, tweeted a list of large Trump donors in his district.
So there are two Castros.
There are two. They're twins.
One of them did this.
Yeah.
And it was confusing which one did it.
So oh, no.
Got, some people
the
got the...
It was the congressman who did it, not the presidential
yes.
candidate.
Which yes. one's the congressman?
It's the one who's not running for president who did it, but people thought he did it.
Sorry. Okay, so Joaquin Castro tweeted it, but yes. Julian Castro didn't condemn his twin for it, I guess is what happened. And the... You know, this
talk about identity issues.
First of all, should twins be allowed to be president? Strong no. Too creepy. Too many chances for hijinks.
Julian knew he had a premonition that his brother, even though he was halfway around the world, was going to tweet
right.
this.
Obviously, creepy twin connection is fully in action here, including in my brain, since I didn't know which one of them did it.
I think the congressman has grown a beard and mustache, partly so that he's not as easily mistaken.
But that's the best possible way to end up with hijinks, because then the
of
other
course.
One grows
yep.
the beard. And oh, my God, it's a nightmare. Anyway.
Someone should ask how fast he can grow facial hair at the next debate.
That is a vital question
yeah.
that affects our nation.
Be, yeah.
And yeah. also Liz personally, who is a fan of facial hair for those on the podcast.
I really
who don't
just
know.
Hope that Bill de Blasio doesn't have any twins.
We wouldn't have noticed a twin that large, I think. Anyway, all this is by way of saying that his defense about this tweet was, listen, this is public information. And that's true. It is public information. If you give money to a political candidate, to a presidential candidate, to a congressional candidate, it becomes a matter of public record. This is because of campaign finance disclosure laws. And so he just said, listen, I just amplified information that was already out there. I did not go out of my way to find these people or disclose something that had previously been a secret. This seems to me to be part and parcel with the SoulCycle thing, because it's all about what we know and how much it's our business, the way that people participate in politics, especially with their money. My hope is that the end of this news cycle ends with everybody ceasing to give any money to politicians whatsoever, period. Would that be a good outcome, Liz? If people just stop giving money to politicians because it's public? Or,
yes. I mean, yes.
Or would we prefer if those donations were secret?
Or if there's so much of it that...
I think, or they just take money from politicians. That would be the best outcome.
There's already too much money in the system.
No, there's just too much noise. Or we go overboard and people just start putting this all out there, and then it's like, okay, well, then there'll just be too much. People can't bother to care about who does this. You know, like if it becomes a new standard, it just won't matter to people, I think.
And I think it was in the 2008 campaign. It was either 2008 or 2012, but we learned through public records disclosure, which I'm against for political contributions, that Barry Manilow had maxed out the contributions to Ron Paul's campaign. And that made me actually think better of Barry Manilow. And that's a roundabout way of saying,
wow,
I think that there's nothing wrong with what he did. I agree with you, Catherine, that, you know, this country was founded in many ways on anonymous political speech. And I'm against mandatory disclosure laws. But, you know, it's out there. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, because it is part and parcel of how politics is done. I am very much against the idea of politicizing every aspect of life. But it seems to me, you know, that's a totally legitimate discussion. And, you know, one of the problems that we have with all of this stuff is that, you know, so Republicans go bananas because, you know, the Castro brothers are doxing, you know, major donors to Donald Trump or something like that. But they do exactly the same thing. And they're constantly talking about how, you know, this person or that person has a money trail and here you can find it and it's bad. I mean, it's just information.
Yeah, the use of the word doxing to describe anything the other side does that we don't like involving information is very annoying, because they both do that and then call each other out.
Well, there has always been a genuine bit of ambiguity in what that word actually means, right? Like, it's sort of a made up newish word. And the question of whether it means putting information out there which will cause people to get attacked, or discovering information that was previously private and publicizing that information. And I think it's
I think it should mean the latter.
It probably should mean the latter. I think, you know, it may also at this point mean the former in ways that, you know, sometimes I feel the need to like hold a hard line on what like the word peruse means or something, but I'm not sure there's enough historical hard line to hold on doxing.
I'm just really hoping we can call this episode peruse. The Barry Manilow Ron Paul campaign finance connection, because I didn't realize there was one.
And now you know.
And now I do.
You know, we wrote about it like every day for a month at Reason.com, the website of Reason Magazine.
Were you publishing studies about it in Health Affairs? I don't think you were, because that's what I was paying attention to back then.
Yeah. Well, the day that Health Affairs publishes a study on Barry Manilow's campaign giving habits, I think is...
It's over. It's over then.
That's the apocalypse.
We'll have to call the end of everything.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, to me, one of the big takeaways here is, as Nick says, the need to have a space for anonymous, private political speech and even political giving. We are going to have to choose between everything being a controversy or everything being secret at some point. And right now we are fully in the everything is a controversy camp. I don't know if we can roll back the clock on this type of privacy. There are lots of types of privacy we probably can't roll back the clock on, potentially including this one.
But don't we kind of have more privacy? I mean, because like, you know, the phone book used to come out and give everybody's address to everyone like this.
Right. And that
thing
actually came up in this conversation, right? About the Castro tweet. It was like,
yeah.
Well, all I did was put the name and the city where they live, which is literally what was in phone books. And I saw like
right,
a bunch of tweets
a
out there that were like
expectation of privacy. Now, all of a sudden,
Xennials out there forgetting that phone books exist was like the median tweet of this controversy.
Xennials who put literally everything they eat, do and say on Facebook and Instagram.
Not Facebook anymore.
I mean,
yeah. How dare you accuse them of being on Facebook? Okay, so let's move on to what was actually the biggest story of this weekend, which was the jailhouse suicide of Jeffrey Epstein. It happened at 6:30 a.m. on Saturday. Guards doing morning rounds found him dead in his cell. 66 years old, had apparently hung himself. The coverage of this has veered between absolutely crazy Clintonite conspiracy theory mongering and I think some pretty legitimate points about what it's like to be a person with mental health concerns in prison or in jail. Liz, you've written a lot about the need for reform of conditions in prison. So before we get into the Epstein case specifically, can you talk a little bit about some of your work about, among other things, pregnant women, people with mental illness, solitary confinement, and what conditions actually exist in America's jails and prisons?
Yeah, I mean, I think just doing any sort of reporting I've done on different places, any sort of reporting like CJ does a lot of for us at Reason, and, you know, reporting on any sort of county jail system, it's like, wow, conditions there are really shockingly bad. And it makes you think that pretty much anyone that you look into in depth seems to be like that. Just things like, yeah, like leaving people. I mean, with the pregnant women one, there's so many ridiculous examples of people even giving birth in solitary confinement or just being, you know, in labor and being there for hours and bleeding before someone comes to them and stuff like that. The kind of things that they let people alone to do are shocking. And the sort of, you know, we hear all the time about people dying from suicides just in their jail when they're even only in for a night or haven't even been charged or they're on bail or things like that, because, or dying of illnesses because that are very treatable, but no one has given them their medicine. So yeah, I think that's the kind of stuff that with regard to the Epstein thing has been so, you know, everybody has all these crazy conspiracies, which I'm sure we will get into in a second. But I'm really appreciative of the people that are pointing out right now, like how routine this sort of negligence is, because, you know, the guards have even said, like, he was not on suicide watch anymore. Why not? Even though he'd already tried just a little bit ago.
6 days before.
Right. Yeah. But because that's just their protocol, like it's only for so long. Like they were supposed to check on him every 30 minutes, but then the guards just didn't for hours. And I feel like that's a very common thing you hear all the time in these sorts of stories, too, is just guards just sort of aren't. So we don't need to look to conspiracy theories. It's just the sort of general bad job our prison system does.
This does seem to be a classic incompetence over conspiracy.
Yeah.
Sure. You know, test of that.
The facility he was being held in Manhattan also is considered even worse than Rikers, just for negligence and incompetence. But when you think about people like Sandra Bland or Epstein, and it, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to be sympathetic or empathetic towards why they were in jail, but, you know, you get plunged into, you know, a situation that is going to freak out the most stable people possible. You know, it's really not surprising. And, you know, part of what is a genuinely good development over the past few years is a thoroughgoing understanding that criminal justice in all of its kind of manifestations, including being held in jail, much less going to prison down the road or anything, really needs a complete overhaul. And, you know, that, I mean, I think, you know, that's clearly, you know, going on here. And it is disturbing and shameful, I think, the level to which people on either side of an issue now immediately go to the jugular and, you know, drink like Dracula for, you know, conspiracy theories, which have absolutely no, you know, no basis in any kind of public knowledge.
And we're talking mainstream people, like, you know, mainstream journalists, but also some politicians.
Like Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Donald Trump.
Well, yeah. Like, I guess somehow that doesn't even surprise me because he's just always
like Lou Dobbs.
Yeah. Well, Claire McCaskill, who's, you know, a nut in her own way, but just, you know, politicians who are generally pretty, at least in touch with reality some. Like, it's,
yeah. So this is, I mean, but let's for a minute give the conspiracy theorists their due and say, okay, well, the way this case was shaping up, he had lots of information about lots of powerful people. If we think prisons are so badly managed and badly run, what makes us think maybe somebody couldn't have got to him? I'm saying this as a devil's advocate, but what makes us think that, Nick?
The best for the Clinton conspiracy is that I saw somebody tweet that if Hillary Clinton could, or if the Clinton death machine could get him in prison, they probably would have been powerful enough to win the 2016 election.
I mean, to be honest, it seems like a lot easier strangle someone in prison than to win an election.
It isn't hard. No, I have to disagree. It isn't hard for a Democrat to win Wisconsin and Michigan.
Maybe this particular election versus this particular strangulation. I don't know. But, Peter, you're looking disapproving. What do you say?
I don't know. This whole thing just seems sort of incredibly ghoulish and unpleasant to me. I think the point I would make about all of this actually is surprisingly somewhat similar to the one I made earlier, which is that what people have done with Epstein's death, which is a major event in the news, is that they immediately turned it into a referendum on a politician they don't like. And right, it's Clinton body count and Trump body count are the hashtags that circulated along with this. And so the idea was that instantly you would see that here is a horrible development in an already awful story, the details of which are just shocking and atrocious. And what we're going to do here is we're going to say this reflects badly on Hillary Clinton. This reflects badly on Donald Trump. And the hashtags are always accompanied by images of Epstein with Trump or with Clinton. Epstein clearly palled around with powerful people, not just politicians, but a lot of people from academia. He sort of had connections all over the world of intellectuals and politicians in power. And the idea that like that would be how you conduct your public life, your public discussion. Some of these people, as we mentioned, have large platforms, and that would be what they would immediately jump to is, oh, this is a way to get my political enemies and make them look bad, I think is just incredibly repulsive. And it's a bad sign of the times that this is the discussion that a lot of people who are in power want to have.
So let's back up a little bit and talk about what Epstein was actually accused of. I was sort of earlier in the podcast hesitating about how to identify him, but the Times actually does identify him as the financier accused of trafficking girls for sex. Liz, did he traffic girls for sex?
Closer than most people that, I mean, yes, I guess so, yes.
But there's so much
if
noise.
If the allegations are true.
Yes, if
say,
the
right?
allegations are true.
If the allegations are true. But there's so much noise about sex trafficking and about underage sex trafficking. I think listeners and readers could be forgiven for being a little bit jaded about that accusation, right? And this is your beat.
Yes, I hate because I am always using caution here. And I want to I'm always using caution about using this term. So in this case, I don't want to just jump in and call him a sex trafficker too. Okay, but he did, he did pay underage people. Underage people are by definition under federal law, whether they're willing or not, they are, considered sex trafficking victims. So even if we don't take into account any accusations of violence, which I'm not particular, there's a ton of allegations against him too, so I'm not even sure what exactly. I think there are some that involve
there's violence. At least one allegation that he held an underage girl against her will, and that there was coerced sex as part of holding her. Again, this is an allegation, but it's
most
been reported
of the allegations
in major news outlets.
are more of the lines that yes, he brought underage teen girls there and paid them to give him massages and then also do other sexual things and then got them to recruit their friends. So they recruited their friends, which, would technically make them sex traffickers under the law, too. So I'm not trying to defend what he did at all still. And yes, that falls under the federal sex trafficking statute. That falls pretty close to the activity that I think people think about when they think about sex trafficking. So that's, I guess, my
part of the issue. And Liz, I'd be interested in your take on this, given your expertise in it. But it also talking about it in terms of sex trafficking then also kind of obscures the idea of statutory rape, which seems to be why isn't Jeffrey Epstein considered a rapist?
Right. I mean, that's because this is our new,
which seems like. Yeah. I mean, but it's odd because that seems to be a much more a much more serious and disturbing charge. And that almost doesn't even get talked about. And it's kind of in a weird way to talk about these people as trafficked and being paid. And,
right. Because
whatever.
That makes it seem like there's a third party that makes it seem like, I think the thing is that, it's based on how we prosecute crimes too, because it's not going to be prosecuted. It wasn't prosecuted in Florida. So now the feds have to get involved and the feds can't do, specific, if they want to make it a case, it has to involve bringing these people across state lines and doing these things that are federal crimes like sex trafficking, as opposed to, rape, which would be, maybe just, charged at the state level. Usually.
I mean, my suspicion is that if he had lived and the court and the case had proceeded, we would have seen statutory or just straightforward rape charges at some point.
But rape is not a federal crime.
but that somebody would, right? But you can charge somebody with, they wouldn't have just necessarily just charged him with federal crimes. There would have been multiple different law enforcement agencies involved in this, this is my suspicion, and we may well never know at this point, but just based on some of the reporting, it seemed like that was the direction some of the investigations were going. They just hadn't come to that conclusion yet. It was, the understanding was that this would be a months, if not years long investigation against it.
Well, that's what I was trying to say. I mean, obviously, I think that there are, like, I'm not trying to say that that what he did is not, you know, a crime or that it shouldn't be punished under some statutes. I do think that using the sex trafficking law is a little bit because of the way, you know, getting jurisdiction of it, and a little bit because that's side of just what they're charging everyone who does any sort of bad sex thing with these days, because they're trying to get more sex trafficking prosecutions. And they get a lot more asset forfeiture possibilities from doing it that way than if they did it through rape law, which is another thing to consider.
This is something I think that, like, layman watching this case might not appreciate, that there are more factors at play than just what crime did he do, if he did a crime. There is a sort of complicated interplay between what is flashy and headline grabbing, what is considered sort of the worst charge du jour, what is the charging body. And I think that all those things kind of came together in this case to really put the sex trafficking piece front and center, because we're currently having, like, a weird national preoccupation with sex trafficking. We are weirdly, as a country, obsessed with that right now. And Epstein made it real. I mean, he did it
in the way that even the Pizzagate and QAnon and the real fringe conspiracy theorists, I mean, he came the closest to doing what they said. You know, he was palled around with big, important people. He flew people around on jets. Like, that really gets at a lot of their sort of, you know.
What a time to be a conspiracy theorist.
It's a good time for...
Well, it's weird, too. And I mean, this is, Liz, I think part of why your work is really important is that the way sex trafficking charges usually, or discourse gets thrown around, it masks the fact that typically the people who end up actually facing charges are women who are charged with prostitution,
right,
who are ostensibly the victims of sex trafficking. And at least in this case, the actual trafficker was the one who was targeted,
right,
and there was more broad-based sympathy for the, you know, the actual victims of stuff here. But what do you think? I mean, if we, you know, talking about kind of conspiracy theories and stuff, Jesse Walker, our colleague, has written a book about conspiracy theories and has argued that, you know, conspiracy theories speak to anxieties that can't be fully or explicitly articulated. You know, what is the subtext then, you know, of the Epstein, of the fixation on Epstein, and also, you know, all of these conspiracy theories?
Wait, isn't it that sometimes conspiracy theories are kind of true?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fixation is precisely because he seems to give validation to all of these threads that were out there floating around. He seems to give validation, and perhaps does, to, you know, to the idea that every powerful person is friends with every other powerful person, and that they are covering up for each other's malfeasance. And I think that, if anything, is
and
the theme of 2019
corrupt,
or 2020, yeah, the 2020 race. It's that the powerful people are working together either to hurt the little guy or to sort of amorally or immorally just pursue their own ends.
So does that help, or you know, I hate to, like, you know, try and put this in the service of partisan politics, but it seems like both that can help Donald Trump, who makes that kind of case all the time, that the system is rigged and people like, you know, the Clintons are rigging it. But it also speaks to Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and the more populist side on progressives, who are saying the system is rigged and that the powerful people are sweeping up all the marbles and keeping them for themselves, you know, at their fancy billion-dollar retreats and all that.
Right. Well, and don't forget, one of the other pieces of the allegations against Epstein was that he was running an enormous Ponzi scheme kind of grift type thing. It wasn't quite a Ponzi scheme. It was, I guess, more of like a blackmail scheme. But the idea that also the people who are in charge of all the money are sort of playing a shell game with it.
I would say that we don't know that it's blackmail. That's been an object of some speculation, but no more than that. And it's really, I mean, it does, this sort of adds to the intrigue of it, is it really is unclear exactly where he got his money, if he was really a billionaire. Certainly he had access to a lot of funds, but how did he get that access? Who was giving it to him? Was it maybe just a very small number of individuals? Was it a large number of people? He had always been understood to be somebody who was running an elite investment firm, but the reporting on that investment firm seems to suggest that it was not what was advertised.
I just want to say, though, with, you know, I was just thinking when we were talking about conspiracy theorists and when we talk about people like Jeffrey Epstein or R. Kelly, who was also just arrested on federal charges, and both of them were, you know, the charges that Epstein and Kelly were arrested for are for conduct that's been going back years. That's been going back since, you know, the early 2000s. And, you know, Epstein's first trial that he got off was in 2008. So the feds could have picked it up then. And that's really when they started going after Craigslist and then Backpage and going after the online ads and, you know, charging those people as sex traffickers for the past years. And it's just funny to think about, not funny, sad to think about the fact that, I mean, A, they were ignoring these things that were actually happening in favor of this fairy tale, but B, the conspiracy theorists were closer to the truth. Like the Pizzagate and conspiracy theorists were actually closer to the truth about who was doing the, you know, so-called sex trafficking than the mainstream of our progressive and bipartisan actually consensus in government about it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, you know, sort of especially with regard to work, your work, Liz, which has been so valuable and instructive, is just to point out that the distinction between so many, virtually all of the kind of big sex trafficking busts that we have seen publicized over the last 5 years or so as, oh, here we've really stopped a big sex trafficking operation. And in virtually every case, it's something that is very different than what Epstein was doing. Epstein actually seems to be a singular example of somebody who was doing what all of these other in most cases it appears to be Asian immigrants engaged in consensual prostitution, and that's not what was happening here at all. And whatever it was that was happening is much closer to the kind of the myth that has been spread about a lot of these other.
And this story and the R. Kelly story and a couple of others will create, I think, are continuing to create justification for a huge amount of law enforcement effort, a huge amount of spending on both the federal, state and local levels in pursuit of what is likely a very, very rare thing. I think, of course, we see this in lots of other areas, including terrorism, including perhaps mass shootings. There's a pattern in which the truly sensational story that validates a conspiratorial theory will get so much play that it actually changes the course of public policy. I want to talk briefly about the other big news of last week, the raid on a rural Mississippi meat processing plant. Nick, you referred to it earlier. And about 660 suspected illegal workers were arrested. It was the first day of school in that community. So many children came home to find themselves orphaned by ICE, albeit in most cases briefly. I want to talk just about how that case landed in the news. So how that case got covered, how that story got covered. This was a particularly large raid, and the timing of it, settled a certain way into the political debate about immigration. But these raids do happen all the time. I was struck by the parallels between the coverage of this immigration raid and also the ways in which we talked about the violence associated with mass shootings versus everyday violence in Chicago. So I guess I'm wondering, these raids are pretty common. Why did this raid get so much attention this week, Nick?
Well, I think partly because it was the largest raid in years, and it was coordinated, and ICE made it it was a press event as much as anything else, so that it isn't like they did it and then they, reported about it later. I mean, the press knew about this and that as it was happening and whatnot. So I think that's it. And I think one of the things to, consider, and we've talked about this in other contexts, that if you look at Donald Trump's immigration policy, by extension, some of the Republican stuff or people, that it's less about actually getting rid of problematic illegal immigrants or reducing illegal immigration. And it's more about making a splash that reminds people who are worried about illegal immigrants that they're all over the place and that we're never going to be able to get rid of all of them. And also to send a message to illegal immigrants to live in fear. And by extension, legal immigrants and actually legal Americans, because, suddenly you're in something that starts to approach a police state where everybody has to have their papers on them at all time. That's, I think, the essential takeaway from from all of this? Because if you know, first off, Trump is constantly talking about MS-13. Why aren't we reading about massive ICE raids on MS-13 members or, you know, federal law enforcement going after them?
That they weren't all conveniently located in a single building and showing up for their shift to be MS-13.
Yeah. And I mean, but this is, you know, they know where MS-13 hangs out. One assumes it's not like it's not mysterious or anything. And they're actual gangsters and criminals who you know, commit violent assaults on people. Why aren't the owners of these plants, you know, who had, you know, why aren't they being hauled away? Because you, instead of arresting 630 or 660 possible illegal immigrants, all you have to do is, you know, arrest the plant managers, two or three of them, and you would see a change in, you know, hiring behavior and stuff like that. This is where I think, you know, the function of these raids is not to actually get illegals out of it. It is to score political points and to maintain a certain level of outrage. And that works on both sides. But it's despicable because, you know, for fuck's sake, I mean, like the lowest priority of law enforcement should be people who are working hard for a living. Period. You know, whether they're legal or illegal, like those are the last people that we should be, you know, rounding up and processing for arrests and possible jail time or deportation or whatever.
But Peter, they broke the law by coming to this country illegally.
Lots of people break lots of laws. And it's also very difficult. We don't necessarily have, you know, universal enforcement of speed limits of all sorts of things like that. But let's say of pirating music or movies or
no one on this podcast has ever done any of those.
And we
things.
Wouldn't necessarily want to have a very strong enforcement of a lot of those things. But the other thing that I would say is that these are basically unskilled workers. And if you want to be an unskilled worker in the United States who comes here legally from, say, someplace like Guatemala, it's virtually impossible to do so because the type of visa that you would need, there are only about 5,000 of them in a given year. And that's for year-round low-skilled workers of the type that they would have had at a chicken plant, chicken processing plant like this. And so the idea that people can get in line, play by the rules, and come here legally, and it will just work and it's relatively easy, is one that is just not borne out by the reality of the immigration system. And so if what we want is for people to come here legally, and then we need to set up a system that allows them to do so and allows them to come here and work. The other thing that I would add just on the policy front here is that the owner of these plants where the raid took place said, you know, we were among the first companies to sign up for E-Verify. We were way out front. We verify all of our applicants with the Department of Homeland Security and the Social Security Administration. And that's probably true. And what it suggests is that the number one policy that immigration restrictionists want to put in place to try and stop unauthorized immigrants from working illegally is almost certainly a failure and is just going to be a stopgap measure until they say, well, that's not working. We need to do something more.
Right. And Shik Adalmia has done a bunch of reporting on this, both in Arizona and some other Western states where they also tried to implement E-Verify and found that the poorly maintained nature of the databases and also the number of both false positives and false negatives were so high that it was unworkable and actually already backtracked on it at the state level.
Yeah, if you are a legal immigrant in particular, you should be particularly worried about E-Verify because the false positives that are going to say, hey, wait, you can't work, are likely to hit you. There will be people who are here legally who are going to be prevented at least temporarily from working if we end up with a nationwide E-Verify system. And I think that that's something we should worry about.
Liz, the discussion of the fallout from this immigration raid has centered a lot on the families that were affected, right? So lots of heartrending pictures of children, you know, at school gyms and other places where they had been gathered up during the initial sort of bout of anger about crackdowns at the border. A lot was made about family separation and the idea that the Trump administration had done that explicitly, that it was not a bug, it was a feature to make families suffer and make them think twice about breaking the law. Do you think that is the case here? Obviously, that would just be speculation, but I've been struck in both, you know, in both the case of the border and in this case at how that seems to be a real double-edged sword, right?
Yeah,
maybe you are making the families suffer, but you are also bringing sympathy for their cause.
Right. That's what I was going to say is, I mean, I think that there's it very well is possible or likely that this is, yeah, there. This is the Trump strategy. I mean, many people have said that, you know, off the record in the administration have said things like that. But also, yeah, it seems that it has the exact opposite effect. I mean, it probably works both ways. It does probably work for their base. I don't think it works at deterring people more. I don't think that stated goal that you know, being taught about families is going to make families think twice. I don't think that really works. I think it probably does work for Trump, you know, supporters or strong immigration, you know, border control supporters. But on the other side, you get all these images. I mean, like the raids this past week, you know, there were some, they just left kids, I guess, like out in the streets and their neighbors and the schools and stuff had to take care of them because ICE does not coordinate with local social welfare agencies and local governments in these sorts of situations where they, you know, raid the poultry plants and take the parents. So you had kids who were just like left there. And so you have that sort of thing happening, and that sort of creates these images, and that's what galvanizes people. And I think that's what galvanizes people who aren't necessarily, you know, swayed by or interested in or, you know, have any strong feelings about specific immigration policies and specific proposals. But they see things like that. They see, yeah, children being locked up in those detention centers. They see children being left in the streets as their parents were dragged away with ICE, you know, making no plans for how to go after them. And I think that's the kind of thing that really just gets, you know, your average American sort of turning against this.
I just want to quickly note the Trump administration's defense of these raids. First of all, they said they're not raids. They're targeted law enforcement operations. It's like the Obama administration never went to war. It was kinetic military action.
Right.
The Trump
targeted
administration
drone
has never engaged in actual raids. The Trump administration has argued that actually it's the workplaces that are exploiting these undocumented workers and not the Trump administration. And also one Trump administration official talking to NBC this weekend said, you know, we really thought that this was, quote, done with sensitivity.
Whew, doggies. I mean, this is an interesting point, though, right? In the Democratic presidential debates, for instance, we've heard a lot about how companies exploit their workers. This is something that I think many people take for granted. This is also true in discussions about prostitution. If money changed hands, maybe someone was being exploited. And I think that kind of baseline belief that exploitation, like work is exploitation, makes it easier for people to buy that line. Now, I don't know who's buying that line, that the real villain here is the meat processing plant. But I think the fact that they would even try to offer it is interesting.
Well,
and
it's
telling.
Like, it's the same sort of thing as it is with sex work, where part of what, if, you know, I'm sure some of these employers probably are exploitative, but what makes them be able to get away with that is the fact that all of their workers are illegal, because they need to get illegal workers, because these sorts of, you know, meat packing and chicken packing processing plants are the kind of things that it's really hard to staff. We have out west, a lot of them are now being staffed by prison programs where they're sending people as a treatment center instead of, you know, for drugs, instead of going to prison, they can go there, but it's just hard labor. And so because they can't get people to fill them. So it's like, we want to keep people, illegal immigrants, in these jobs that we otherwise need to have prison labor fill. And that makes it, you know, easier for employers to just to be exploitative if their employers are all prison laborers or illegal immigrants.
I just went looking for, there's been a lot of publicity around, because actually some of these raids were telegraphed a couple months ago, right? We actually like had been primed to see raids like this coming. And many publications and activist groups put out tips for immigrants about what their rights are, what they should or shouldn't do in the event of a raid. And one of them was just don't answer the door. One of them was literally don't open your door when a law officer comes, which
yeah,
is...
Yeah, aren't conservatives supposed to be concerned about the low trust society thing?
I think Nick is concerned about the low trust society thing.
But also Fourth Amendment rights and all of this whole story is so damning, I think, to the current moment in America, because, again, you know, if you are against illegal immigration, you know, start with obvious criminals and then work your way down to people who might have kids who are actually American citizens, who are working, you know, who are working, and businesses that, yeah, they can marginally exploit workers more who are illegal, but they're also in industries that are so desperate, the only people they can hire are illegal immigrants, because nobody else will do the work. So it's, you know, there's an obvious way around this, which is to open up the labor system in a way that, you know, when we at Reason, we must run this at least once a month for the past 10 or 12 years. the you know, quotes from the 1980 presidential debate between George H.W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, where they are kind of taunting each other about who will do more to incorporate illegal immigrants fully into the fabric of American culture and economic processes. We are so far away from that. It's just, I think, really devastating. And it's there's something deeply sick, I think, with people who see, you know, families being separated, whether it's at the border or in these raids, and their only answer is, well, they broke the law, they deserve it. What kind of piece of shit parent, and I write a lot about this, and my Twitter feed is filled with this, of what kind of piece of shit parent would, you know, come here illegally? And it's like anybody who, like, who wants something better for their kids. And like, if we can't manage a modicum of empathy and a kind of humanity towards those people, we're just in a very, very bad place as a society.
I want to note two pieces of news coverage around this. One, I just was looking for the stuff about the earlier telegraphed raids, which were actually in July. I said a couple months ago, but that's because time is infinity now in 2019. There was the acting head of ICE was furious and actually said at a press conference, there were people in Congress sitting there giving instructions to people illegally in the country and telling them how to avoid detection. There's no way for us to quantify what impact it had, but you couldn't turn on the TV anywhere in this country for several weeks without it being one of the lead topics. Like, this is a bad situation where we have the head of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency furious at politicians for telling people who live in their districts their rights. That's not good. That's not where we want to be. Other helpful news story that I just found when searching for this. Advice to illegal immigrants looking to avoid detection, : don't work in pot, from the San Francisco Chronicle. So there's a perfect convergence of all of your black and gray markets together. Maybe don't work in like massage and or pot.
There are signs really all over my neighborhood, which I find, because Mount Pleasant, where I live in D.C., is like one of the D.C.'s only heavily Hispanic neighborhoods. And there are just signs about how to avoid and what to do if ICE comes to your door and stuff, like stuck on all the lampposts and everywhere these days.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we should be encouraged that people are.
Another kind of adjacent to the conspiracy theories, and what does a particular conspiracy tell us about the cultural anxieties or social anxieties? I think the fixation on illegal immigration is also worth thinking about in those terms, because illegal immigration is at like a decade-long low. The economy, there's less reason to be worried about illegal immigrants in particular, or even immigrants stealing your job, because they, you know, that we're at or below full employment. So what's going on here? And it seems to me it's another reflection of this broad-based, transpartisan, kind of ubiquitous feeling that the system is no longer working, you know, and it's an economic system, a social system, a cultural system. And, the, you know, for me, looking, because we're still at in the early stages of the 2020 election, and it's already a total fucking dumpster fire. Like, where does this go before people are finally like, okay, you know what, we have gone down to the bottom of the barrel in terms of like horrifying rhetoric on both sides, dehumanizing of enemies who in the most cases have very, you know, almost everything in common and very little that separates them. You know, what extinguishes this kind of dumpster fire? And then we can start having, you know, and I'm going to say it, we can start having productive conversations rather than... you know, rather than these weird kind of flame wars that are just, you know, that are disturbing and disgusting and completely counterproductive for anything represent, you know, anything coming close to getting on with the 21st century.
Sometimes the only way to put out the dumpster fire in your heart is to consume something good in the media. So let's awkwardly Matt Welsh transition into what you consuming. Peter, what did you consume this week?
I have been watching The Boys. It's a series on Amazon. It's an 8-episode series that is based on an old Garth Ennis comic book. And it is the low-level premise is, what if all the superheroes that people love were celebrities who were secretly the biggest jerks in the world? And I mean, not just like they're kind of snippy. I mean, sometimes they murder people because, you know, they don't care that much. And what they're really out for is government contracts. And this is actually part of what makes the show fascinating, at least from a libertarian perspective, is that one of the ways that they show that these people are bad is on the one hand, they're trying to, well, there's talk about, oh, we're privatizing the military and police, but it's that they're seeking government money to become a huge government contract to police, say, cities, and then eventually do national defense. I haven't finished it yet, but this is a series that I think could have gone very wrong. The original comic book is so referential to a bunch of obscure 1990s comic book stuff. It's all about how comic book creators and the comic book industry is actually kind of horrible. But what they've done with the television series is they've kind of reimagined it as a satire of the superhero movie industrial complex. And so it's all kind of references to Hollywood celebrities, basically. And the idea is that your favorite celebrities are probably bastards, and so are these superheroes. And it's actually kind of great. It's a little bit too over the top at times. So if you have issues with, say, certain types of gore or vulgar humor, I wouldn't recommend it. On the other hand, it's pretty effective as a very pointed satire of superhero movies and the celebrity industrial complex.
My Instagram has really, really, really wanted me to watch that show. Like, it's the only ad that I'm getting in Instagram. And normally Instagram just thinks I want to watch movies about moms drinking wine. So I've actually been really delighted to see it in there.
Peter, please tell me that Jeremy Piven stars as himself in it.
Sadly, Jeremy Piven is not involved. But the cast is not super well known. It's got Carl Urban in it. But the cast is really surprisingly good, especially the people who play the big superhero team, who are not folks who you have likely seen before, but they're really quite good.
Do they all have convincingly strong jaws?
They do, although not all of them have convincingly strong muscles. Some of the super suits look pretty padded.
Oh, dear. Liz, what are you consuming?
I was going to do something else, but now to keep with our terrible immigration conversation, I'm going to switch it up and say that I recently watched this movie on Hulu. It's part of their Into the Dark series, which is they have one a month come out. They've been coming out since last October, and they come out like based around a different holiday. Mostly real holidays. One of the months was International Women's Day. I guess that was March. They didn't really have a real holiday that month.
March is a week holiday month.
But the July one was that came out in the early July. They're each like an hour and 20 minutes long or something. So like full length, you know, movie-ish. And it was about a woman who was trying to cross the border and to escape violence in her hometown in Mexico. And she tries and it doesn't work. And so she tries again. And then she gets apprehended by ICE or by border protection, by border agents. And I won't say what happens next because it's a sci-fi sort of series. It's a sci-fi series and horror. So she
Spoilers.
Wakes up. Yeah. So she wakes up in a place and then, you know, everything is not as it ends up seeming. But it's really good because I like it. I mean, all of these movies, they all work on a level where they're just sort of fun and or, you know, they're good entertainment. They're good sort of genre movies, but also, you know, a lot of them do have a sort of weird political tie-in, like the International Women's Day one actually was about like a Me Too sort of situation, but it had a really bizarre twist too. And so this one, you know, I just thought it was interesting to see there's actually, you know, some commentary on this current like moment of border control, like in this art form, just sort of very casually stuck into an otherwise pretty, you know, lighthearted thing, which is kind of interesting. But it also kind of ends up, you know, coming out in unexpected ways so that it condemns not just the sides you would think, maybe. So,
I mean, it is kind of interesting that low and medium budget horror ends up being the last place where you can make successful original features that also have social commentary built into them. I think of stuff like Get Out and Us in particular.
Yeah,
but also
this
movie that was pulled
like that.
That was supposed to be coming out later this fall called The Hunt.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Which Donald Trump tweeted and complaining about, not by name, but it was clear which movie. And it's a riff on The Most Dangerous Game, but for a polarized America. Literally the title, the original title for the movie was Red State versus Blue State. And it's about how coastal elites pay to go hunt deplorables. I'm using language from the script, so that's not my take on it. It is literally about how elites who view themselves as elites go and pay a lot of money to go to the, to go and
so
shoot.
So what you're saying
and
is
murder.
It's a very, very subtle social
yes.
satire.
Honestly, I'm going to read you a line. I think maybe we are better off without this movie. I think this is on the one hand kind of terrible, but here's our line from the script. Did you see what our rat fucker in chief just did? One elite asks another. Another responds, at least the hunt's coming up. Nothing better than going out to the manor and slaughtering a dozen deplorables.
Wow.
Wow.
Okay.
I thought when Liz was talking about a movie about an illegal immigrant who comes here and steals an American's job, she was watching the original Superman movie.
Ooh. I actually thought when you said the name of the series that you were going to talk about the new film adaptation for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark, which is happening, and which I don't know if y'all have childhood memories or memories from your own children of the of those series, those stories. But
I don't have any childhood memories.
I am still lightly traumatized whenever I see a woman in a choker, thanks to that book. So I'm not ready to see a Guillermo del Toro adaptation of those books. I can't do it. What am I consuming is, could be the mysterious pill that was left on my desk this morning. Y'all, I just want to talk
it.
About this
you
for
gotta
a minute.
Take it.
So I get it to
take
work.
It now.
I was out at the end of last week up in New York. I arrive. There is sitting in the middle of my desk, just a small red pill with an X on it. Just waiting for me.
Wait, did you literally
like Alice
get
in Wonderland style?
I got red pilled. I don't know what's going on.
I think you went for red pill and I went for Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, both of you. Yeah. That was like absolutely like Peter versus Liz's frame of reference.
But the scene in The Matrix references Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the deal. I'm not going to take it because I'm not an idiot. But if anybody left me a red pill with an X on it on my desk, please let me know that it was you because I'm troubled.
Because you're going to take it anyway.
I'm not going to take it. Who would take it?
Take
what
it,
kind
Kat.
Of person would take
what,
it?
What are you dead inside that you wouldn't
I will
take
be
that
dead
pill
outside if I take it. I will be. All the sides will be dead. My actual recommendation is the Intelligence Squared podcast. I realized about myself that I realized about myself that I'm like a serial monogamist with podcasts. Like I listen to one for a while and then I'm like, it was a good run. And I just like break up with it and completely forget about it. And so I'm looking through the graveyard of podcasts on my phone. But my current love is IQ Squared. I've listened to probably 4 or 5 of them. They're very good debates. Nick, you've done these. Jacob Solomon has done mm-hmm. them. I'm slated to do one coming up soon, which is why I started listening. But they are, frankly, extremely good and worth it for anybody who likes a kind of formal, pro and con, like Oxford-style debate engagement. So strongly recommend.
I think John Donvan, the moderator, is also, just epitomizes a great debate moderator.
They're very well managed.
Forces a serious conversation and doesn't let people talk past each other or squirm out from vagueness or kind of diffidence.
And of course, just to put in a plug, if you like those style of debates, you should probably also listen to the Soho Forum debates, which are hosted on this here podcast. Nick, take us home. What are you consuming?
All right. So I watched consumed many, many things, but I will focus on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, the Quentin Tarantino movie that came out a few weeks ago, and Peter has talked about it. But what is particularly, I guess, in light of the conversation that we've had today, what's fascinating to me is, it's set in 1969 in Hollywood, and it's the story of an aging kind of slumping TV Western star who's getting into spaghetti Westerns and is worried about his career, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. His stunt double and personal fixer is Brad Pitt. But he lives next door to the house where Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate are living. And you know that it is going to be Leonardo DiCaprio's story merging with the Manson murders because it's building up to the early August murders of Sharon Tate and her friends on Cielo Drive. And what is really interesting to me is that it ends, without giving any spoilers, it ends up monkeying with the timeline in a way that I think this is actually one of the paradigmatic ways we're talking about culture now, whether it's Man in the High Castle or a number of other shows, of like, how can you reimagine history in ways so that we are not in the place that we are right now? And it seems like everybody is everybody is unhappy for many, for different reasons. But it's a kind of an interesting imaginative act of how history can be different. And it's a phenomenal movie that is well worth watching.
And in that respect, echoes a lot of Inglourious Bastards and Django Unchained,
absolutely.
Both of which were kind of alternate histories that offered violent revenge as a fantasy of great satisfaction and catharsis.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well put.
That's all the time we have for the Reason Podcast, a podcast of violent revenge for satisfaction and catharsis.
Catharsis is what that red pill on your desk is.
I know.
Going to
Maybe
cost.
I did take the pill, you guys.
Catharsis is.
That's actually,
you know,
sounds like a,
most drug plants cover.
I think that's
it,
a
know?
Superhero.
The little red pill with an X on it.
Like she's got ears and Anyway. Thank you for listening, everyone. And thank you especially for special guest star Liz Nolan Brown's contributions. Next week, Matt Welsh will be back.